Kol hatchalot kashot is the Hebrew phrase, all beginnings are hard. Even when you begin little things, they don't always work out the way you intended. Starting last week, Howard Lessner, our executive director, and I decided that it would be helpful if we sent out the subject of the forthcoming sermon by email. By the way, if you wish to be on this list, you can just be in touch with Howard Lessner and give him your email address, and he'll be happy to send it to you each week. This is only the second week in which we have sent out the subject of the sermon, and I dutifully prepared a sermon on whether it is ever good to hate, and I had that sermon prepared when all of a sudden it became apparent that a major world figure was near death. And I received calls from a couple of media outlets to ask if I would be willing to talk about the Pope's death. I will sometime, they at least thought yesterday, be on CNN tomorrow morning, although when, God only knows. They think between 7:30 and 8:30, but I wouldn't wake yourself up because... And I said certainly that I thought that it was very important actually to talk about, and then I realized that I had to talk about it this morning. So that my second announced sermon topic will have to wait till next week, and we will delay hate for 1 week, come back next week for hate. This morning it's Catholics and Jews. And I hope that in the course of speaking about the Pope, it will become clear why it is so important not to let this moment pass by without comment. Although when last I heard, Pope John Paul II was still clinging to life, his death was imminent. And so I think this is an opportunity for us to review what not just his papacy meant, but what the history behind it is, as we close off one of the longest papacies, actually, in the history of the Church. It was only in the 4th century, with Constantine, that the Christian Church and the Western European state became so intertwined that the conflict between church and state was a constant theme of the Middle Ages. For a while at the University of Judaism, I used to teach medieval history. And one of the three or four continuous threads that runs through medieval times is who rules the state, the Pope or the king. And that wasn't just the state of what we now think of as Rome or Italy, but all through Europe. Once there had been a split, and the Eastern Church, that is the area that we now think of as Turkey and surrounding, that became the Ottoman Empire, was the Byzantine Church, which was very separate from the Catholic Church, the Church of Rome. In fact, you could make the case that Orthodox Christianity and Catholic Christianity are at least as different in a way as Christianity and Islam or Christianity and Judaism. They're very different from one another, and the Pope had virtually nothing to do with Byzantium, except when he invaded them. And the relationship between the Eastern and the Western Church was something actually that this Pope apologized for in the course of his papacy. But once the church and the state became all but one, and the mechanism of government was behind the ideas of religion, there was a constant intermittence. Sometimes it was greater, sometimes it was less. Effort to convert, drive out, or destroy those who were not of the church. In other words, the Jews. Because although there were, from time to time, other small groups, and the history of Catholicism is littered with heresies that were destroyed in the most brutal and savage and murderous ways, to be a heretic, by the definition of the church, was at least as bad, and in some instances far worse, than being a Jew. Because the heretic had to be wiped out completely. The status of the Jew was different, as I will explain in a moment. Although to be a heretic was worse, the Jew constantly suffered throughout our history from being the outsider. For a long time, you know, Judaism benefited in a perverse way from the fact that we were the ones who had rejected those whom the Christians considered God. And the reason we benefited is that the church believed that it was important that the Jews survive, but survive in an abject state, that is, survive in terrible condition, because that way they could testify as to what happened when you reject Jesus. We call the Kotel HaMaravi the Western Wall, but you know, a lot of people call it the Wailing Wall. And if you want to know how it got the name the Wailing Wall, the answer is that when Jerusalem was controlled by the church, Jews were allowed to visit the wall one day a year, Tisha B'Av, so that they could file past the wall and cry for the destruction of the temple, so that all the Christians seeing them would know this is what happens to those who reject the Lord. Now, I could spend all morning telling you stories that we don't want to hear about what it was like for a Jew in the history of Western Europe. A history, by the way, that did not change with the Reformation when Protestantism was born. Because Martin Luther, the genius, and he certainly was a genius, who began Protestantism, began it in part with the thought that the Jews would come and join him, now that he had relieved them of the burden of the church. But when he realized that the Jews would not convert, he wrote things that to this day are among the most savage and stomach-turning anti-Semitic statements penned by anybody in the history of Europe. In time, through the Enlightenment, the 18th century, the 19th century, the 20th century, the church and the state became separate. The Pope had less and less influence over the heads of state, and in fact, in a famous phrase, when someone said to Stalin, "But the Pope will object to what you are about to do," Stalin said, "How many divisions does the Pope have?" After all, he had an army. The Pope had only the powers of persuasion. There were, of course, popes who were more and popes who were less sympathetic to the Jewish people. And all of this as a backdrop, as in our day everything that happened to the Jewish people in Europe must be a backdrop to the Shoah, to the destruction of one-third of all the Jews in the world during the Second World War. Out of that war came the first pope whom one could say, without an ironic smirk on one's face, that he was a friend of the Jews. That was Pope John the 23rd, a remarkable man, who for the first time began to feel the tremendous burden of guilt that Christianity bore for its treatment of its sisters and brothers who gave them Jesus for the past 2,000 years. But I say began to feel because teachings didn't change, institutions stayed the same, and what the historian Jules Isaac called the teaching of contempt, which lives till this day in many places. That is, in textbooks, in sermons, even in movies, the teaching of contempt did not change. A debate was begun over the question of Pope Pius in the Holocaust and his place in the Holocaust, what he did and what he did not do, a debate that persists till this day. We have had speakers about it here at Sinai Temple, David Kurtzer, and we will have a speaker in our coming centennial year, Rabbi David Dahlin, who is coming out with a book that to a great extent defends the position of Pope Pius in the Shoah, and I hope you will come and listen to him and hear what he has to say and disagree with him if you choose. And then came Pope John Paul II. In order for us to understand this individual from our own sectarian point of view, because his biography, which is a biography of a world figure, is not so much our concern this morning, I will tell you that the small town in Poland in which he grew up had 10,000 people. 2,000 of them were Jews. One-fifth of his town. He grew up, as did many Poles, Ukrainians, Estonians, Latvians, Russians, Germans, in constant interaction with and close to Jews. The difference is that he didn't forget them. Through the war and afterwards, the Pope's allegiances were clear. This is, after all, the Pope who extended diplomatic recognition to the State of Israel. Recognition which, unbelievably enough, between 1948 and 1993, the Church refused to extend. The state, which they had made necessary, they would not make official. And in extending recognition to the State of Israel, this is what the Pope said, it must be understood that Jews who for 2,000 years were dispersed among the nations of the world have decided to return to the land of their ancestors. This is their right. He knew, having lived as a young man through the Shoah, what happened, which is why in the most dramatic moment for the Jewish people of his papacy, the first visit of any pope to the land of Israel. He made sure that he visited at Yad Vashem, and there gave a speech in which he referred to the Shoah as the Shoah and not as the Holocaust, and called it a sin against humanity and against God, as anti-Semitism is a sin against humanity and against God. That is and remains a remarkable statement for the leader of the church to make. And if you don't think that it is remarkable, then all you have to do is search through the opposition that he received from within the Catholic hierarchy for these statements. It's not that everybody believed it and he just gave voice to it, any more than the Catholic hierarchy was pleased when he apologized to the Eastern Orthodox Church. Institutions, as individuals, don't like to apologize. And heads of institutions don't like to apologize, even for the most grievous crimes. In 1998, marking the publication of a document called We Remember, a Reflection on the Shoah, Pope John Paul II wrote, "On numerous occasions during my pontificate, I have recalled with a sense of deep sorrow the sufferings of the Jewish people in the Second World War. The crime which has become known as the Shoah remains an indelible stain on the history of the century coming to a close. Remembrance of the Shoah is an essential component in fashioning the future." Now, having said this, I don't want to leave you with the impression that this was a pope who was unconditioned by the training of his church or of his past. There were things he did in the course of his papacy which enraged, and rightly enraged, every Jew who paid attention. I would wish, for the sake of his reputation and the purity of his soul, that he had not brought Yasser Arafat into the Vatican. I wish at least as much, perhaps even more, that he had not brought the former head of the UN into the Vatican, who was a war criminal and was clearly responsible for crimes against Jews. But there isn't much that we can do except to protest, as we protested against his beatification of certain saints who, from the point of view of the Jewish people and the way they treated Jews and spoke about Jews, were no saints. Our voice in these decisions was a small voice in a big world, and we were not heard. But even giving that, it would be churlish, foolish, narrow, and ungrateful not to realize that this pope's position was different from that of his church and that of his predecessors. That it took 2,000 years for a pope to stand up in front of the world and say, "We have sinned towards the Jewish people." For a pope to set foot, as no pope has done in modern times, in a synagogue, which this pope did in the synagogue in Rome, to meet with the chief rabbi of Israel, as this pope did on more than one occasion, to realize that the Jewish people have a living covenant with God. There are what, 15 million Jews in the world? There are over 1 billion Catholics. That's a lot of people. And the fact that their church, which is represented by the Pope for the first time, said an al chet, a pakavi, a we have sinned, is something that should remain with us as we watch those who cared for this Pope mourn his passing. Despite all that we have gone through and all that we have suffered, we do not have the right to demand of any figure in the world that they do everything to our pleasing or everything to our standards, or they anathematize those whom we anathematize, that they dislike those whom we dislike to the same degree as we do. We try, we persuade, we argue, but there will be differences. But this is a man who sparked the solidarity movement in Poland and was clearly instrumental in the overthrow of the largest slave state perhaps known to humanity, the Soviet Union, who understood the position of Christianity through its history towards the Jewish people, which gave it birth, and also knew that the Jewish people looked to him not for his blessing of us, but for his redemption of his own tradition. His position in dialogues with the Jewish people was not as a superior. And for that too, he deserves a certain tribute. I want to close by saying that all of this is completely apart from any positions that the Pope took on Catholic doctrine in the world. His position towards medical experimentation, his position towards the nature of marriage, all of that is not an appropriate subject for comment or discussion in a synagogue on such a day as this. But in terms of this Pope's position towards the Jewish people, although we are not without grievance, we are surely with thanks. This Pope is a remarkable man, not only because, as a member of the resistance in his youth, he recognized the evils of Nazism and communism that followed, not only because he could converse in 28 different languages, was a poet and a theologian and a charismatic figure, both as a young man and as an older man, but because he knew what the church that he represented had done to the people who gave it birth. He saw it with his own eyes. I don't know if you watched any of the pictures in the last day or two, But I saw one poignant shot of peasant villagers gathered in the church in the small Polish town in which he was born, to which he returned in a celebrated visit to Poland, and I thought it surely crossed his mind that there are no Jews left in that town, and very few left in that world. When someone begins to undo a great wrong, it is hard to celebrate because you cannot divest yourself of the feeling that if the great wrong had not been done, the apology would not be necessary. But he is an individual. He is not a people. He is not a history, and deserves, as all of us do, to be judged on his own actions. And taken only in relation to our tradition and our history, for good and for bad, considering the world from which he came, the church in which he was raised, the teachings which he heard, as did every Catholic in Europe for 1,000 years, day after day, year after year, that he grew up to be the person who apologized to the Jewish people, who traveled to Israel, who visited Yad Vashem, who went to the synagogue, who embraced rabbis, who spoke the truth, is an extraordinary feat. For that, he deserves our tribute and our thanks and our prayer that his passing be easy and that his memory and the best part of his legacy be for a blessing. Amen.